Interested in the forces shaping our world? The Council on Foreign Relations has you covered. For those who like to look ahead, dive into The World Next Week, hosted by Bob McMahon and Carla Ann Robbins.
We were not forecasting anything about Russian domestic upheaval, and yet that has been the story of the week.
These were scorpions going after each other in a bottle.
And for those who want to go beyond the headlines, join Jim Lindsay as he opens up the president's inbox.
What should U.S. policy do?
The approach towards China, it's enough to make me question bipartisanship.
And finally, join me, Gabrielle Sierra, on Why It Matters, as my guests and I bring some of the world's most compelling stories home to you.
Do you feel good about where we're heading with AI?
Maybe we need to invent a new word here, which kind of is a combination of frightened and excited.
I'm
excited.
So what are you waiting for?
For the world next week.
The President's Inbox.
And Why It Matters. We'll see you soon.
A jailed women's rights champion in Iran wins the Nobel Peace Prize. Narges Mohammadi has been an activist for more than three decades and in and out of prison for much of that time.
I'm very, very happy for her that finally she is getting the world recognition that she should have really got many years ago.
Her former prison mate tells us the Nobel is a win for the whole movement. And a human's voice, it turns out, is more fearsome than a lion's growl.
All of the animals from the smallest little gazelle up to elephant, they told us that their most feared enemy are humans.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, a grandson pays homage to a legendary grandfather who taught him how to listen.
Brazil's full of melodic birds. They sing beautiful melodies. And he got very inspired by them.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. We start with a woman being celebrated on the global stage for her activism while being imprisoned at home.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2023 to Narges Mohammadi for her fight against the oppression of women in Iran.
Narges Mohammadi is an Iranian women's rights activist. She's been in and out of jail for much of the past two decades and is currently incarcerated at Evin Prison in Tehran. Our guest served time in Evin Prison with Narges Mohammadi. Anna Diamond is a British-Iranian and is now a researcher at Oxford University, and she joins us from the UK. Anna, you know Narges. You were imprisoned alongside her. What does her Nobel win mean to you?
It's a really, really well-deserved victory for all of us, but especially for Narges, who started her journey 32 years ago. So she's been doing this for a very long time, so selflessly, and she recognizes that for the most part, it's been a thankless job, but I'm very, very happy for her that finally she is getting the world recognition that she should have really got many years ago.
Now, the Nobel Committee called Narges the undisputed leader of the women's rights movement in Iran, but many American listeners may not be familiar with her work. What has given her that status?
She's been a tireless advocate to abolish the death penalty in Iran. She has refused to remain silent on the sexual harassment of political prisoners. And she opposes also a number of government policies that have been detrimental for Iranians domestically and also for the Iranians in diaspora, such as the harassment that diaspora members face abroad. So her work is wide-ranging, but she's much loved by those who know her, and this opportunity has given her the visibility for others, for, as you said, the wider American population to also get to know her and her work.
As we mentioned, you served time in Evin Prison with Narges. How did you come to meet her there?
Yes, so I was imprisoned in Iran in 2016 for false allegations of espionage, and I was accused of spying for the UK and the US, which were completely baseless. I spent multiple months in solitary confinement, and when I was finally moved to the public woman's ward, that's where I met Narges. I hadn't seen a fellow human being for months, so naturally when I was suddenly in a room full of women. I broke down and I cried and I was very disoriented. And Nargis really took me under her wings. She was like a mother figure, not just for me, but also for a number of other women who were there. She's so human and so humble. She values human dignity, but also she understands that there are some real struggles and fights that we need to collectively come together and stand against. And she's never been afraid of the risks that it carries. And all of it has actually, in fact, come at a great personal cost.
Do you think her winning the Nobel Peace Prize will make life any better for her in prison, or perhaps worse?
From my own personal experience, I believe that the more recognition and visibility you have, it will serve you better. Of course, there will be some backlash. She might be transferred back to solitary confinement. But at the end of the day, because she's such a high-profile political thought leader right now, they truly cannot treat her as badly as they perhaps did years ago, because now all eyes are on her.
As you know, protests since last year's death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody in Iran, they've grown into one of the most intense challenges for the Iranian government. What does this Nobel win mean for Iranian women generally and the women's rights movement in Iran at this moment?
I think it's a recognition for women's ongoing courage and resistance, even in the face of, you know, heightened animosity and aggression. And I think this Nobel Prize is really a gesture, a sign that they are not alone and that the world stands with them.
The Iranian government appears to be clamping down much harder on women in recent weeks and months. Has that quelled the momentum we saw last year?
The crackdown that the government has put on the past 12 months has definitely had its effect. But I do think that the momentum is still high and people are really trying to change things within their own capacity as much as they can. It's little braveries of every day, whether it's taking off the headscarf when you go to buy a pint of milk or walking out on the street holding your boyfriend's hand. These things, we take them for granted, but for them, they're really acts of bravery and resilience.
Anna Diamond served time in Evin prison with Nargis Mohammadi. She's now a graduate researcher at Oxford University in the UK. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Anna.
Thank you so much, Carol.
The late Senator Dianne Feinstein is being remembered this week for the mark she left on politics in California and across the country. But for one Oakland family, her impact was much more personal, as KQED's Tyke Hendricks reports.
At yesterday's memorial service at San Francisco City Hall, there were 1,500 invited guests, including Vice President Kamala Harris and Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. Another guest was Maria Mendoza Sanchez. She's a nurse at Oakland's Highland Hospital. She's a wife and mother, and for decades, she was an undocumented immigrant. But she and the senator formed a special bond in 2017 when Mendoza Sanchez and her husband were facing deportation to Mexico and leaving their four children behind.
She understood me as a mother, as a human being. She knew what it was to be breaking a family apart.
Mendoza Sanchez had reached out to Feinstein's office for help, and the senator pushed hard to keep the family together. But the Trump administration was ramping up deportations, and the family's luck had run out. The day before the flight to Mexico, Mendoza Sanchez got a call. The senator wanted to meet her. Vianey Sanchez Mendoza, the family's oldest daughter, picks up the story.
The senator had her staff drive her from her office in San Francisco all the way to our little neighborhood in East Oakland.
Vianey says Feinstein took her mother's hand and assured her that her kids would be okay.
And she hugged my mom. She hugged us. She definitely made my family feel like we mattered, like we did belong here.
The senator invited the kids to her home for Thanksgiving that year. And 18 months later, with Feinstein's help, Mendoza Sanchez was able to return to Oakland and her job on a temporary visa for skilled workers.
I really, really thank Senator Feinstein for everything she did to me, because I wouldn't have been able to come back.
The relationship Feinstein developed with the family was a side of the senator that the public seldom saw, says her press secretary Adam Russell. But those personal connections kept her grounded while working in Washington on big policy issues like immigration.
We're not just talking about numbers. We're talking about real people, people whose lives are affected by it. And she realized that.
In 2019, after Mendoza Sanchez was back, Feinstein invited her family to lunch on the San Francisco waterfront. Vianney was a recent graduate of UC Santa Cruz, but she had put her plans on hold to take care of her younger siblings while her mother was gone. Feinstein asked her what she wanted to do with her life now.
And that was a very daunting question to be asked by a senator. And I just let her know, I want to use my experience and what we went through to help people. I want to make a difference in my community.
Soon afterwards, Feinstein offered Vianney an internship in the district office. That later led her to a job assisting crime victims and the inspiration to build a career in public service. For The World, I'm Taiki Hendricks in San Francisco.
Without teachers, it's near impossible to educate children. And that's exactly the problem facing schools around the world today. Globally, there's a shortage of 44 million teachers, according to a new UNESCO analysis. To learn why the profession is in crisis, we turn to Fernando Reimers. He's a professor of international education at Harvard. Fernando, 44 million, that's a lot of teachers. Why is there such a large shortage globally?
That is a lot of teachers, and I think that the report indicates what some of the main reasons are. The profession is not sufficiently attractive to both get people to become interested in being a teacher or remain in the profession for an average career length. But I do want to underscore another message of that report, and that is the urgency of providing teachers the professional support they need to actually deliver on all the expectations we now have on schools. We hope schools to prepare students to understand about climate change, to develop social-emotional skills, to develop 21st century skills. And those things are only going to be possible if teachers receive adequate support. And this report basically says we're not doing that.
Globally, is the shortage getting bigger, staying the same, getting smaller?
Yeah, so the shortage has gone down from 69 million in 2016 to 44 million today. And of those, 15 million are needed in sub-Saharan Africa.
Why is that?
Well, it is the region of the world with the greatest population growth. So in many ways, the challenge is larger. It is also the region of the world where there has been less progress in expanding access over the last 15 years. And it is also the region of the world that faces a tremendous burden from servicing the debt that many countries have. And as a result of that, the fiscal capacity of governments is more constrained.
In this UNESCO study, is there information about why people are deciding not to go into teaching or perhaps quitting the profession?
The report says there are basically various reasons. Bread and butter, the incentives in many places, material incentives, are not enough. Second, just as importantly, working conditions. The conditions that teachers find when they arrive in the schools are not adequate for many of them to be able to teach their students, so they don't stay. And the pandemic has had an impact in some settings, in that it has made the task of teaching more onerous on individuals, more challenging, more difficult.
I understand that the analysis by UNESCO did have one bright spot, which is Asia. Mm-hmm. There, the teacher deficit dropped pretty dramatically in recent years. First of all, what kind of drop and what's behind the change?
The answer to your good question is basically simple. When governments make it a priority to fund education and to fund positions, they see the kind of progress that you see in regions like Asia. Where they don't make it a priority, then it's a little harder.
What are the different ways teachers are viewed around the world? Like what's an example of a culture that is really supportive of teachers?
Singapore would be a great example, but Vietnam also. These are places that have tremendous respect for education. You do see a celebration of teaching in public transportation buses. There are messages that say we celebrate our teachers. And as a result of that, entering the teaching profession, when people apply to college, which is the time by which they have to decide whether they want to be a teacher or a doctor, there are very many applicants for every teaching position. And then they enter into an institution that provides them a five-year education, so the equivalent of a BA and a master's degree. and they receive a very good preparation, comparable to the preparation you could receive at a place like, imagine if our teachers were prepared at MIT or something like that.
What about this? What countries in your assessment should be doing well but are not?
Well, countries that spend a lot of resources on education on a per capita basis, but that have bad results. An example of that would be the United States.
Fernando Reimers is a professor of international education at Harvard. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The audio you're hearing sounds innocuous enough, a man speaking in measured tones. But when that audio was played for elephants at a watering hole in South Africa, they heard a predator and ran away. This is sound from one of a number of videos taken by conservation biologist Liana Zanet in South Africa's Greater Kruger National Park. Zanet recently published the results of this research and joins us from the University of Western Ontario in Canada. Professor Zanet, your paper is called Fear of the Human Super Predator Pervades the South African Savannah. Before we get into the research, tell us why you chose a watering hole in the South African savannah to do your study.
Yeah, water holes, they are a super important resource for all of the mammalian community out there on the savannah, which is why we chose it. We worked in the dry season in South Africa, and the dry season means it's dry. And so there's precious little water around, but they do remain in these water holes. And so what we wanted to do here is set up a camera trap, which we put on a tree about 1.5 meters up. That's connected to a custom-built speaker that plays a sound. And the idea is that we have our camera sort of trained toward the water hole. We know that animals are going to visit the water hole because animals need to drink. They trigger the camera, and then that starts a video, and then that triggers the speaker, and the animals hear a sound.
I've watched a number of your research videos. They're really fascinating to watch. We're going to play one now, and maybe you can talk us through it. This one shows some rhinos at a watering hole. They hear the recorded sound of a lion's growl being played. Describe what happens.
Animals, when they hear lions, like you saw with the rhinos, what they would do is they would frequently kind of run, right? They'd run some distance away, but then they'd stop and they check things out because they figure, you know, well, okay, there's a lion here. And for rhinos, they often back up when a predator is around. And then, you know, they figure, okay, well, I can handle a lion. And so all I need to do is be some distance away and I'm fine.
Now, here's another video at a waterhole with rhinos, but you're playing recorded human voices this time.
Volgens Godse woord het hy alles.
Tell us what happens now.
The behavior is remarkably different. They look up, they attend to the sound, and then they realize we got a lethal predator here that I won't be able to defend myself against. I'm out of there. And so they run away and they leave the water hole. And 95% of the species that we looked at did exactly that. They were two times more likely to run when they heard humans in conversation and compared to lions. And they left that water hole 40% faster when they heard humans talking compared to lions.
So the takeaway here is that these animals were way more frightened of humans than the classic apex predator, the lion. Were you surprised by this?
Yeah, I was. Because it kind of makes some sense. But on the other hand, you know, the magnitude of the effects here that we see are really quite remarkable. Like being two times more likely to run because you're hearing humans talking, like humans just being out on the landscape compared to lions. All of the animals from the smallest little ungulate, gazelle, you know, to warthogs and zebra and, you know, giraffe, up to elephant, right? They all did these responses. They told us that their most feared enemy are humans.
Now, what's so interesting here is that you're studying the fear response in animals, the ecology of fear, as you call it, including the health impacts. How does being frightened in this way, how could it possibly impact the long-term health of these animals?
Yeah, so in the ecology of fear, what we focus on is the fact that because predators are lethal, that prey are going to be enormously afraid of them, right? They're going to do everything they can to avoid getting killed in a predator attack. So doing these behaviors like running away and, you know, moving out of the neighborhood when you think that a dire threat is there, that makes perfect sense. And it's largely beneficial to the animals. Like, it's hugely beneficial to the animals in keeping them alive another day from a predator attack. But then on the other hand, it does carry costs. And you saw some of those in the video, you know, where they're leaving the water hole, right? Like, it's the dry season. They're down there to drink. But a human is there ruining it. And so now they have to travel somewhere else and find another water hole. And so that's travel time, you know, and it's a cost. And one thing that we do know, one common thing is that scared prey typically eat less because you're running away if there's a predator there, or you're not going into the habitat where a predator is, even though it has delicious food in there, right? And so what we've shown in manipulations before in field experiments is that just thinking that predators are around, and we've done this using sound, reduces the number of offspring that animals can have by 53%. So this in and of itself can reduce population numbers of prey. The fear of predators is the thing that can reduce population numbers.
What are the practical uses of this research?
The results really are, the responses of the animals really are quite remarkable. Like, I mean, who knew that they were that afraid of just us being out there on the landscape, right? And just talking. So there's that. But then on the other hand, it's really depressing because we're everywhere, right? And look at the effect that we're having on these animals. And so what we would like to do is try to sort of do the flip side, right? And make this use this information as positively as possible. And that would be to maybe we can use the fear of humans, the scariest predator on the planet, as a conservation tool for prey species. So, for example, in South Africa, rhino poaching is a huge problem. Rhino poaching has gone up exponentially since 2008. It's a real crisis. They're, you know, losing rhinos like crazy. And so one idea would be that you would have seen in the video that rhinos run when they think that humans are around, right? Like, they leave the area. And so an idea would be to go to South Africa and find locations where poaching is quite heavy. And then what we might be able to do is set up an array of speakers playing just humans talking. The idea being that rhinos will recognize that a lethal predator is in there, so they don't go into those areas, and so they don't get poached.
Very interesting. So kind of using kind of the bad news about humans as a way to actually save the species or prevent further deaths.
Yeah, to do some mitigation. I mean, wouldn't that be a nice thing for humans to do?
Leanna Zanett is the lead author of the study, Fear of the Human Super Predator Pervades the South African Savanna, just published in the journal Current Biology. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. For months, U.S., Ukrainian, and Russian ad campaigns have all been competing for Russian views.
The message is, join the army, be a hero, and then get your money.
That's the Russian ad. The U.S. and Ukrainian ones have very different messages. That story and some music to kick off your weekend ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. If you see someone shoplifting in the UK, Britain's Minister of Policing wants you to step in and stop them yourself. That was the advice this week as retailers across the UK struggle with a surge in thefts. One British retail body estimates shoplifting is costing store owners well over $1 billion a year. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports that shopkeepers are fed up.
Ben Zelfaratnam owns a small family-run convenience store in Croydon in South London. A local TV crew went to interview him recently about the problem of shoplifting. And here's what happened while they were filming.
Young businessmen or women will want to go into business.
I think he's stealing.
Hello, excuse me. Right, did you take it then?
During the interview, one of Selvaratnam's employees spotted a man in a khaki-coloured jacket putting two bottles of beer into his coat pocket. Selvaratnam calmly asks the man to give the beer back. He does, and Selvaratnam lets him walk out of the store.
I mean, it was relatively painless in the fact that he gave it and just walked out. In some situations, they don't walk out. They get really, really violent and abusive.
Selvaratnam has been running the store for the past 8 years. In the beginning, he tells me, there were 3 to 5 shoplifting incidents a week. Now, there's several a day. And he says he's been attacked numerous times.
You know, I've been bottled with wine bottles stolen from us. We threatened with knives. Or they lift up their sweatshirt and there's a concealed weapon in their waistband.
Two of his staff walked out earlier this year after they were attacked at work. This week, 86 retailers across Britain signed a letter calling on the government to make the assault of shop workers a specific crime. The UK policing minister then suggested that shopkeepers and members of the public should detain shoplifters themselves using the powers of citizen's arrest. And it seemed passers-by outside a supermarket in Essex this week did just that. In a video shared online, 3 men can be seen packing goods into the boot of a black car. As they climb into the car, a group of men run over, shouting at them. They open the car doors and drag 2 of the suspected shoplifters out. A 3rd suspect runs away. They then pin them to the ground, knees on their backs. But these weren't regular bystanders. They work for this man.
On Monday, they were at the office at a nearby premises doing handcuff training.
This is David McKelvey. He's a former police detective. His company, TMI, investigates shoplifters for private clients. On that day, he says, some of his workers, many of them former police officers, were on a break from training when they spotted commotion in the car park.
Fortunately, they had handcuffs because obviously they were on handcuff training. Police took about, I don't know, 25, 30 minutes to get there and agreed to arrest them for theft stroke robbery.
McKelvey says his services are in high demand. People often blame the cost of living crisis, he says, but that's not really a factor.
The gangs that are out there are either organised criminal gangs, and there's lots of them. The other significant numbers are people with drug addictions or alcohol addictions.
They steal, he says, because they know they'll get away with it. One British supermarket chain said this month that more than 70% of their calls to police went unanswered. Emmeline Taylor, a criminology professor at City University of London, says lack of police resources is a big issue. But calls from shop owners, she says, should not be ignored.
Retailers are only reporting the most serious incidents, and those incidents usually involve violence, weapons. And so the police need to recognise that when retailers do call in, it's because they need an emergency response.
But Taylor says what really needs to be addressed are the root causes of shop theft and why people are driven to commit this crime in the first place.
We need to have more investment in social services. We need more drug rehabilitation. We also need better investment in mental health facilities.
And Taylor says telling retailers or members of the public to tackle shoplifters themselves is a terrible idea. Croydon shop owner Ben Selvaratnam tried to make a citizen's arrest once, he says. It did not end well.
We kept them for 2 hours. After, you know, repeated calls, the operator said, look, just I can't guarantee a police response will be anytime soon. Just let them go. The biggest ish problem was he didn't go. He then continued to stay outside, threatening, shouting, smashing things.
Selvaratnam says he rarely calls the police anymore. Earlier this year, he put his shop up for sale. But so far, he says, he's failed to get a buyer. Right now, he says, he just keeps going, hoping for better times. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
When an iconic tree fell in the UK last week, the only people who heard it fall were the people who chopped it down. But the outcry has ricocheted around the world, with thousands of messages of grief and anger pouring into local businesses and preservation agencies. The stately sycamore tree stood in the natural dip between two hills in northeast England for some 300 years. It was the site of marriage proposals and the spreading of ashes. A local police commissioner called chopping it down stealing joy itself. The tree was nestled next to a section of Hadrian's Wall, the Roman-era barrier that's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Now, British preservation officials say the wall appears to have been damaged when the tree fell on it. A spokesman from Historic England has told the BBC that the group hasn't been able to do a full investigation yet, but an archaeological appraisal is in the works. Two people, a man in his 60s and a 16-year-old boy, have been arrested in connection with the sycamore tree's destruction. They've been released on bail. In recent months, Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. have been running online ads targeting Russian citizens. Russia wants more men to join their military. Ukraine wants them to lay down their arms. And the U.S. has its own goals. The World's Daniel Offman reports.
Russia's recruitment ad launched in the spring. The YouTube video depicts Russian men living ordinary civilian lives, working at a grocery store, driving a taxi, or going to the gym. At the end of the ad, the tagline says, "You're a man. Be a man." Joining the military is the solution to a mundane, meaningless civilian life. Oh, and by the way, the ad also says monthly payments starting at 204,000 rubles. That's about $2,000.
The message is join the army, like a volunteer, be a hero, and then get your money.
That's Irina Baragan, an expert on Russia's security services. She says that the messages about manliness, heroism, and service are present, but they're secondary.
I mean, I don't think that the simple videos on Instagram and on TikTok can really have a serious psychological effect on people. Money has psychological effect of people. Poverty has psychological effect of people.
According to Baragan, especially in places outside of big cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg, military advertisements are all over.
There are a lot of simple advertisements set near the highways, in the cities, on the streets, on the bus stops, everywhere, with a very simple message.
That message, sign a military contract and get paid. On the other side, Ukraine is trying to counteract that message with its own ads, targeting those men who have already joined the Russian armed forces. In this ad, Ukraine is warning Russian soldiers that their lives are in danger. The ad ends with this slogan: are you willing to die for Putin, or will you live for yourself? Then a number appears on the screen where Russian soldiers can reach out using an encrypted messenger app. The ad campaign is part of a project run by Ukraine's military intelligence called I Want to Live. Here's Vitaly Matvienko, a spokesperson for the project. Matvienko says the campaign is aimed at Russians who understand what's going on. Those who are rational thinkers, he says. They're the ones who reach out.
По програмі здалось
216 people have used our program to hand themselves over, Matvienko says. Once they're in Ukrainian custody, the Russian soldiers become prisoners of war. Matvienko says part of their ad campaign is to show Russians that POWs are treated well and they have nothing to fear. The U.S. is also trying to reach out to Russians with its own ad campaign.
Раньше я верил, что правда имеет какую-то ценность.
This ad, produced by the CIA, depicts a well-off Russian government employee, a family man, someone who stands for strong values and honor.
Как бы я хотел снова поверить в то, что правда имеет ценность.
The voiceover says, I want to tell the truth. I want to believe again that the truth has value. At the end of the video, the caption says, those around you may not want to hear the truth, but we do. Then the CIA logo appears, followed by details of secure ways to get in touch. Here's James Olson, former chief of counterintelligence at the CIA.
They are correctly assuming that there are some good Russians out there.
including intelligence officers, who are secretly opposed to Putin, who are ashamed and angered at what their country is doing to Ukraine, and would like to find a way to strike back as a matter of conscience.
Olson says that right now the timing for this ad is perfect. Former CIA senior operations officer Mark Polymeropoulos agrees.
When you conduct recruitment operations, you're not telling them what they're doing is against their country. What you're telling them to do actually is against their corrupt and rotten government. And in essence, by helping the United States, you're actually helping your country. You're helping Russia.
Polymeropoulos says there's a secondary effect that the CIA's videos have.
You know, it's almost this kind of vicious trolling campaign. And of course, it's driven the Russians nuts.
The CIA ads were shared widely on Russian social networks, and that can help the U.S. recruit more people.
This is what we're supposed to do. It's the nation's first line of defense. Our job is to steal secrets from our adversaries.
Former CIA counterintelligence chief James Olson says he has reason to believe that the ads are already yielding results. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
The American passion for Brazilian music goes back decades.
Tristeza não tem fim, felicidade sim.
That's the voice and music of Antonio Carlos Jobim, a.k.a. Tom, from 1958. He had a slew of songs that were popular here, with some hitting the U.S. pop charts. Now Tom's grandson, Daniel Jobim, is making his mark on Bossa Nova and performing the songs his grandfather pioneered. Earlier this week, he spoke to The World's Marco Werman, but first, just a bit more music.
Samba, so dance, samba, vai, 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 vai. Samba, so dance, samba, vai.
Another Tom Jobim classic there, this time in the capable hands of Daniel Jobim, who joins us from the road in Atlanta. What a great way to honor your granddad with this tour, and you're taking this on with singer Seu Jorge. So it's a new generation of Brazilian artists looking back. How did you and Seu Jorge think about your grandfather's incredibly vast songbook? I mean, so many songs to choose from. It must have been like kids in a candy store.
Yes, we are so blessed. We feel so good playing all the beautiful songs to new audiences, and feels great to keep the music alive.
How hard was it for you and Seu Jorge to select songs from your grandfather's songbook?
Oh, it wasn't hard. He called me if I wanted to do a show with him. I said yes. So we were celebrating, and then we just had one or two rehearsals. We put the most famous songs together and some of the songs, less known songs also. And it wasn't difficult. And Seu Jorge is amazing. He sings beautifully, and, you know, he's so talented. So we just have fun. It wasn't difficult.
Seu Jorge is a kid who grew up in the favelas. Is it fair to say your grandfather's music reaches across generations as well as social classes?
Yes, it's amazing. I'm always, also many countries that nobody knows where Brazil is, and they hear Bossa Nova all around the world and play the songs. My grandfather's music reaches all places.
Se você insiste em classificar meu comportamento de anti-musical, eu mesmo mentindo devo argumentar. Isto é bossa nova, isto é muito natural.
What are your early memories of your grandfather, Tom Jobim? Not just as, you know, a celebrity and a musician, but, you know, as your grandfather.
Yeah, he taught me how to hug trees, you know, and listen to the birds. He was an ornithologist, and he knew all the birds and all the songs of the birds. And he said, it's so good that you like birds too, because I can't talk to anybody about it, because nobody understands. So we would talk a lot about nature and birds and forests.
I had no idea that Antonio Carlos Jobim was an ornithologist. How do you think that influenced his music?
Oh, yeah, all his melodies, because he had a master called Villa-Lobos, was a Brazilian classical composer.
Hector Villa-Lobos, yeah.
Yeah, Villa-Lobos had lots of bird influence in his melodies, too. So my grandfather said sometimes when he reads Villa-Lobos music, he knew what bird he was trying to mimic there in the songs. And so, you know, Brazil is full of melodic birds. They sing beautiful melodies. And he got very inspired by them.
Daniel, I'm going to put you on the spot because asking you to select one of your favorite songs by your grandfather is probably like asking a parent to pick their favorite child. But do you have a favorite song of your grandfather's, one that we can play out?
Well, I love Waters of March because I was born right there when he recorded. I was born in 73, so Waters of March was brand new. And the children in school, all the children would say, oh, his grandfather wrote É Pau É Pedra, which is the opening line. They would say, the kids would say, oh, É Pau É Pedra, his grandfather wrote É Pau É Pedra. It was funny.
What a great song, though, Águas de Março. Musician Daniel Jobim, grandson of Brazilian legend Antonio Carlos Jobim. He's on tour with Seu Jorge performing the music of his grandfather, what will undoubtedly be a memorable evening. Daniel Jobim, thank you for speaking with us. It's great to meet you.
Muito obrigado. Thank you.
É o pé, é o chão, é a marcha estradeira, passarinho na mão, pedra de atiradeira. Uma ave no céu, ave no chão, regata, uma ponte, uma fonte de pão, e o fundo do poço, o fim do caminho, no rosto um desgosto, é pouco sozinho, é estreve, é prego.
Christian missionaries have long traveled along the Amazon, spreading their gospel. In recent years, Muslim missionaries from Turkey have been doing the same, setting up boarding schools in Brazil to teach indigenous children to read the Quran. They've even brought some children to Turkey to continue their religious education. And that has triggered an investigation in Brazil. For our series, Sacred Nation, the world's Dury Buscarin reports.
Last year, a Brazilian journalist named Thales Alcantara got a tip from a government source. A Turkish religious group operating in the Amazon was taking indigenous children out of the country without the proper consent from their parents.
Uma coisa que eu acho importante pontuar.
Alcantara writes for Metropolis, an online investigative newspaper. He traveled to a town in the Amazonas region on the Colombian border. To visit villages, he took a long boat, sitting low in the water. There, he says, people started to talk.
Já era uma fofoca, já era rumor.
It was already gossip. There were already rumors.
Many indigenous families knew about a boarding school in Manaus, the capital of the Amazonas region. Called Asham, it was run by a Turkish religious group. Alcantara met teenagers who had stayed there. They were learning how to read the Quran. One agreed to be filmed for a video published by Metropolis. In Tucano, the language of the indigenous Desana people, the young man details a typical day: waking up, cleaning, then prayers, lessons in Arabic and Turkish, cooking and serving lunch. Students told Alcantara that they were forbidden from swimming in the river. That's a huge part of their culture. But their teachers claimed that taking their clothes off in public goes against Islam. Another student told Alcantara that he missed eating fish. Students were only allowed to eat halal meat.
Eles eram obrigados a rezar, obrigados a seguir os costumes islâmicos.
They were forced to pray, forced to follow Islamic customs, to the point where issues that are part of the culture were prohibited.
Punishment could be physical. One student told government investigators that he was pushed against a wall for refusing to pray. But many parents told Alcantara that they sent their children to the boarding school willingly, even though they didn't know specifically what their children would be doing there. Maria Rosita, the mother of a student, speaks in the Metropolis video. We don't have the means to continue studying like that, Rosita says. I'd like him to finish his studies and find a job. This worried Alcantara, he says. The missionaries targeted teenagers from one of the poorest and most vulnerable communities of Brazil. For parents wanting to keep their kids safe, a religious boarding school didn't seem like the worst option in the world.
There were very strict rules, but at the same time, you also had children and teenagers who were happy to go on weekend trips, to be in a different place, to have access to quality internet.
Six students even traveled to Turkey to attend boarding schools there. The missionaries came from a religious group in Turkey known as the Süleymancı sect. They were founded in the 1920s by a Turkish Sufi cleric. Today, the Süleymancis run a network of dormitories and Quran schools across Turkey, as many as 1,000. Their critics call them a cult.
And the idea is not to develop religious scholars. The idea is that they would have their own professional careers, but they would bring up in a religious environment and live accordingly.
Salim Çevik is an expert on the influence of Islam in Turkish politics. He works for a think tank in Berlin. He says that as the Turkish government has become more religious, sects like the Süleymancis have flourished. They've expanded internationally to Africa and the Amazon.
Well, it's missionary zeal. I wouldn't seek for other secondary motives. They have many religious schools, charities, other organizations.
The World reached out to the Süleymancis for comment. We were directed to a spokesman who hung up when he heard we were journalists. After that, he did not return our calls. In Turkey, the Brazilian teens from the Amazonas region joined thousands of Turkish children in Süleymancı-run dormitories across the country. The Turkish press picked up on the Metropolis investigation about those Brazilian teens, and it reignited a national conversation. What are these religious sects doing in these dorms? Are they safe? Celine Nekepolu is a children and families lawyer for the Turkish women's rights group Morçata. At a cafe in Istanbul, she pulls out her laptop to count dozens of cases against religious groups. The Süleymancı are listed in several articles.
Bilgilerin netleşmeye başladı artık. Önceden fısır fısır fısır.
In 2016, a fire broke out in a Süleymancı-run dorm, killing 11 schoolgirls and one teacher. In another case involving a Süleymancı Quran course, 7 boys were sexually abused by the teacher. Nakapolu says those cases are the hardest to prosecute.
Şimdi cinsel suçlar tabiatı gereği.
Nakapolu says generally these cases have no witnesses, and children are threatened, so they don't speak out. She says in Turkey's justice system, there's a sense that religious people have good morals. Many also have connections to the government. But in Brazil, there are strong legal protections for indigenous children. There's an office called the National Foundation for Indigenous People, or FUNAI for short, which investigates cases like this one.
Então, a FUNAI, esses servidores da FUNAI que foram junto com...
Lucia Alberta Andrade is the Director of Sustainable Development at FUNAI. We spoke to her on Skype. She's also a member of the Barre people of the Amazonas region. She says she was horrified when she visited the boarding school in Manaus. It was an affront to their right to live with their families, and it was an aggression towards their cultural traditions, Andrade says. Brazil's federal police got involved, and within months, the Süleymancı's boarding school in Manaus was closed. The Brazilian teens living in Turkey were brought home. But they told investigators in Brazil that they met other teens from South and Central America who were still in the Süleymancı schools in Turkey. Andrade says she hopes those countries will check on their kids, too. For The World, I'm Derya Buscarin in Istanbul.
In most of the world, football refers to one thing. It's the game where you kick a ball around with, you know, your feet. But in the UK, that will change for a moment, at least this weekend, when American football takes the field in London.
He threw it right into the hands of Darius Williams, who's going to take it all the way to the end zone.
New York's Buffalo Bills will play the Jacksonville Jaguars on Sunday at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time. It's part of an international tour by the NFL with stops in England and Germany. In a promo video, the NFL says these games are to thank the fans watching across the pond.
This is for the night owls, the ones who watch late into the evening in dark rooms glued to small screens. This is for the 5 a.m. finishes, the bleary-eyed mornings, for those who no longer need to touch down on a plane to watch the game. No. They can now watch touchdowns at Tottenham and trade their late nights for the day.
Tickets start at about $80 in London, but stateside fans won't be left out. The games will air on the NFL Network, and to support the Buffalo Bills, New York Governor Kathy Hochul has loosened state liquor laws so that more sports bars and restaurants can serve up pints in time for kickoff. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.